So good afternoon. Again, my name is Robert Roser, and I'm serving as a co-chair for the meeting. And I want to welcome you back. We're hoping that you're all settling in well here, and that the morning practice period help people experience what we envisioned as a soft landing into this space. This afternoon, we're going to start the intellectual and contemplative talk side of our week together. I'm going to introduce, we'll have a contemplative talk, time for questions, and a break, and then we'll have a science talk this afternoon. And so it's my great honor to and pleasure to introduce Sensei Zenju Earthlin Manuel as our speaker this afternoon. She'll be speaking on the topic, The Quest for Serenity Among the Disenfranchised. Sensei is a Zen priest and an acclaimed author who hails from Oakland, California, and we're just delighted that we could get her here in New York to be with us today. She has experienced training in the Nichiren tradition and is also a Dharma-transmitted Zen priest in Suzuki Roshi's Zen lineage. She trained at the San Francisco Zen Center for many years. And she tells me that she is the only African-American Zen priest with Dharma-transmitted teachings in that lineage. Thus... in her life's work and writing, Sensei has been a pioneer for helping people of color and others navigate the Dharma and Dharma communities. And we briefly had a chance to talk about her work, her book, which I have on my bookshelf but have not finished yet, The Way of Transcendence.
Tenderness.
The Way of Tenderness, sorry.
I like that transcendence.
Sorry about that. I should have... And in this book, she explored the role of race, gender, and sexuality in spiritual life, especially for those from historically marginalized or oppressed groups. And interestingly, and I'm so curious, I have beginner's mind when it comes to Zenju, so I'm so excited to hear from you. She suggests that what she was trying to do in that book is, in part, change the conversation around race, gender, and sexuality to frame those identities as the very Dharma doors that could lead us to liberation. And so we're just very delighted to have you here today with us. And without further ado, I present Sensei Zenju Earthlin Manuel.
Okay, after all this technology around me, I won't touch anything. So I'll stand up a little bit. Good, greetings. Good to see everyone. I want to thank Mind and Life for inviting me twice. I didn't come last year. I said, I guess I'll say yes. This time. Saying no, they're not going to stop inviting me. So I wait for people to forget. We forgot about her, but they didn't. And so they invited me again, and glad to be here and to see your faces. And I feel I'm in a room of people who I feel just automatically a kinship. That you're here because of what we're talking about and what we're inquiring about and what we want to discover about this life. And that excites me. I just, you know, some of my friends, they just rather not. And they go to the park, go to the beach. And I like to talk about a lot of things. They say, here comes Zenju with all. She wants to talk, pontificate about something. And I do, because I've always thought about things ever since I was a very little child, young. And I think that was because around the age of 7 or 8 is when I discovered that my skin color was not acceptable, and I didn't understand that. You know, a kid, you know, like, what? I didn't do this. And so it didn't really stop me from being who I was. And I always asking questions that... would make adults like, you shouldn't be talking about that, you're a kid. you know, some questions, always asking questions and inquiring. And, you know, at 8 years old, I decided to be an activist. And also, I was also very religious. So I would go to church, and every time they said something that didn't sound right to me, I'd raise my hand, and and they would ignore me because I was this little kid, you know. I was just very interested in who are Adam and Eve, you know. And I wanted to know more about them since they were my relatives. So anyway. And, you know, are they my uncle or my aunt? So I had a lot of questions about life and death because a childhood friend died. And when she died, that shocked me because I didn't know children died. And I wasn't thinking death was real. I only saw it on TV. And so I think that really began my spiritual journey. And I'm glad of that. Not that she died, but I'm glad that I knew her and that this incident happened to me very early in life. I was about six then. And because it spurred on my quest to look at what is this meaning of life, what am I? And I would get in the mirror and I would stare and look at with my eyes, and so long it would scare me because I was like, who's in there? You know, I was already asking, who am I? And what's in there? And all kinds of things would come up like, well, maybe you've already died and come back, you don't even know. And that would really scare me even more, you know. So, you know, I was always inquisitive. So around 11 years old, I actually was introduced to Buddhism at 11. So 11, this is not in a time when everyone is knowing about Buddhism. I was born in 1952. So we weren't hearing about Buddhism, but I did. And I was always curious as to what it was. Not that I went into it, but I did hold it as something to maybe in the future would come back to my life. And it did. It did come back. And I think because I was open to the meaning of life and what this is, life and death. And so I named my talk The Quest for Serenity, Serenity Among the Disenfranchised. The Quest for Serenity Among the Disenfranchised. And so when I wrote that title, I said, that sounds pretty good. And then later on, it's like, I don't really know what it means. And so, and so I thought maybe, you know, we'll explore this together. And I will, you know, let you know what came up for me and the questions that came up for me and the thoughts that drove this topic. So I'm always open to what comes to me from the silence, and that's what came to me. So it always comes to me before I know what it's about, and then I walk it. The book was that way, The Way of Tenderness. It's like, this is not a book. This is not a book. The whole time I was writing it. And still today I go, this is, it needs more, more, more. Because I'm still walking it. It's a question. It's always the question, always the quest. So having a discovery and an inquiry is most important. That's the most important place on a spiritual path. If you're walking and you're just looking, you're just a seeker, just looking for what can be given to you, what can change you, what can take away what you don't want, that is not a quest. And it's okay to be a seeker. It's not a bad thing to be a seeker. Because at one point I was seeking. And then it became a quest. You know, I was seeking what is life and death. And then it became the quest. You know, the discovery. So as researchers, I know you know all about it. You know, what is the question? You know, what is the inquiry? And how does that inquiry affect how we live today in this time, in the 21st century? So I'm hoping that, you know, we can, together in this time, look and discover and have an inquiry around serenity. So, what's serenity? What is that? You know, what does that mean and what is that about? It sounds really nice. serenity. Is it real? You know, is it possible? Have I had it? Can I have it? Is it important? What is it? Is it just being calm, untroubled, peaceful? All these different terms. And I thought, maybe yes, and maybe not. And so later on, I'll talk a little bit more about how I began to look at serenity. So, and then I said, among the disenfranchised. So some may feel they're not marginalized, they're not disenfranchised. But when I used the word disenfranchised, I meant anybody who had bought a franchise. And what is the franchise as an American? What is the franchise we buy into? American Dream, someone said. American Dream. And so each one of us has some piece that we bought into at some, we might have given it back, some of us are thinking about giving it back. But in this sense, I thought, well, disenfranchised is a good word then in that sense, that we are all looking for some piece of it. And then when we get in business with it, we're like, oh no, this is not quite where I was going, but this is where I was led to. So I think that we're talking about mental habits. And for me, mental habits is not, it's always described, especially in the Buddhist world, as something you want to refrain from, you know, having this habit of the mind, in which the habit tends to lead you to suffering. But I always like to turn the teachings upside down a little bit, and I see that there could be a mental habit of questing or inquiry or discovery. And so we just spent a half a day, last night and a half a day, sitting in silence and allowing it to come into us. Now, we may not know the reason, or we may have some reasons for why we did this or why we do it. And my, I would say my perspective is that we do it so that we can decide what is the quest, what is the spiritual quest, and what is serenity, and what is disenfranchised or franchised? What are these things? Not from our mind, because we can figure that out. Matter of fact, someone could just Google it right now, serenity and disenfranchised, and quest, all of it. Just Google it, get the definition. But I was told a long time ago in elementary school, a teacher said, you know, all the words in the dictionary are made up. And I said, really? Yeah, she said, people make them up and then they go in the dictionary. I said, really? And that just like really blew my mind. It really excited me. I said, I'm going to change all the definitions. Wow, I'm going to try that, you know, as best I can. And I think that in some way brought me into writing. So I work with everyone who is walking the path of Dharma, but because I'm one of few teachers of color in the Zen world, a lot of people of color come to me, and I work with them, especially African Americans, and especially queer African Americans come to me with their quest for serenity. And so I'm on the ground working a lot. But at the same time, I have a question while I'm working with them, and I have them have a question on the path, so that we're not just working what has been imposed upon us, the definitions and the meanings imposed upon us, that we're working with what we're going to discover with each other and what we're going to inquire about our lives, so that we can experience the freedom that we want and the liberation that is real, not imagined. So, I've done a lot of work, research myself. I worked for two think tanks. I worked for the National Council on Crime and Delinquency for many years, and I also worked for the Urban Rural which is Naga Herbal Rural Research Association. And I worked in the field of education and crime among youth, mostly black and brown youth. And it was astounding to be an investigator in that world as it began to shift and change, as the violence became heavier and heavier and heavier, I found myself enabled to continue the research. And also to engage in the world with just the definitions and the meanings of life that have been taught to me, imposed upon me, but not the ones I had gone out and made some kind of inquiry about. So when I think about myself and how I came into Zen, which I, Buddhism I kind of fell into. I tell people, and they always laugh at me, I said, I'm not really interested in Buddha or Buddhism. And they go, you kind of look like it. They don't believe me. They don't. Yeah. And I was saying to someone, the difference between us, Zen and Vipassana, is we have a wardrobe. And so when we teach, we have to put on the swag to go with everything. And actually, it does make me feel good. It makes me feel like I've stepped into a sacred space. I think someone was talking about that earlier. And to remember what I'm doing. And just wearing this, this is sewn by many people. This was sewn by the recovery community of the Zen Center for me. It's their stitches, stitch by stitch by stitch by stitch. One stitch at a time, no sewing machine. And that just makes me feel good to bring them here. And I'm right here. And I can walk with them, they help me walk and be here. And friends and family have stitches on here too. So it really has a meaning. And the robes keep you warm sometimes. And I think having sacred clothes during sacred anything ceremony, and I feel this is sacred, you wear it, you know. I also practice in the Lakota Sundance community for 17 years, 18 years as the head singer and drummer. And I had sacred clothes for that too, you know, that I only wore there. And people say, you don't look like that in the world. I said, no, I don't wear those outside. And I don't wear this outside either. Zen priests are to fit into the world. So it's important to remember, to me, in wearing this, that I'm still on the quest and on the path. And I've committed to it. I've dedicated myself to sit, to listen to the silence, to listen to the earth, and to see what needs to be said, heard, asked, especially in these times. I remember when things changed because of the election in 2016, and I was telling everybody to sit, and they were like, what? You know, just sit still for a minute. Just sit still for a minute so that we could see what to do in this chaos. And that's what sitting does for me. It gives me that opportunity to open up to all the chaos in this world and in my life, personally and collectively. So serenity is a little bit more than calm for me, a little more than being untroubled or peaceful. How many were completely peaceful and untroubled while they were meditating? Just like, oh yeah. Okay, that's right. That's right. You go through this jungle, this inner jungle. What I noticed with people of color especially, that when they take on this practice of sitting, they're not trying to be Buddhist. They're not trying to be a yogi at all. They're looking to become a person, to be a person. There's a saying, I have a few Haitian friends planning on going to Haiti soon, and there's a saying that when someone says, where are you from? That's how we say, where are you from? And we say, New York, DC, LA. What that question means to Haitians, and a friend of mine said this to me, so if she's wrong, I'll call her up and say, you're wrong. But lake, that's the word that says, where are you a person? That's when they say, where are you from? Where are you a person? And I was like, wow. That's important. That's an important question. And I do feel that the quest for serenity among the marginalized or disenfranchised is that quest for personhood. Or anyone who feels they're dehumanized, objectified, invisible, ignored, not seen. And it doesn't matter if it's internal trouble or external trouble, it's both. It's trouble. It's just trouble, troubling. So can we have serenity? Can we have wellness? So I know there's a lot of measuring of meditation in relationship to wellness, in relationship to having a peaceful life, a stressful life. You know, is that possible with people who live or impacted strongly by systemic oppression? Is it possible? And of course I say yes, I do, but not because it sounds like Buddhism is a good thing. I say yes because of the 30 years I've done it and have walked with it and know exactly how it has impacted me and how I am walking in the world with all of it. All of it, the internalized oppression and the freedom. The times of self-hate and the times of self-love. The times of trouble and no trouble. So I was taught to engage life through the Zen practice, how to engage life. We're going to talk a little bit about that as we go. I wanted to... I think the quest is a call for human dignity among all those who don't feel or have that. And we'll talk earlier about what you might see that quest as. And so this is historical. It's gone on for since there were human beings, I imagine. So I have this picture of Sojourner Truth, and in her speech, a women's rights speech, she says, "Ain't I a woman?" She was seeking personhood in that talk to a large audience like this of those who were fighting for human women's rights to vote. Frederick Douglass was in that audience as well. There were several people who were there. And so this one is a very powerful statement, a very powerful call. "Ain't I a woman," she says. You know, "don't I have the muscles of the man? Don't I do some of the work that men do?" I mean, she was a slave and speaking out for women's rights. You know, very powerful. And so her personhood was important to her wellness, which I think is what happens for people of color when we join in on the practices of silence and mindfulness and meditation or yoga. This was a strike. And let's see, what year was this? Was 1968, yes, April 1968. I Am a Man. And these are the sanitary workers that, you know, they clean the street and pick up the trash. And they decided to strike. That was pretty bold to do that in 68 when you were black and didn't have, you know, maybe able to get a job. And so again, a fight for personhood. Two men had been killed the night before, and I wanted to say their names, Echo Cole and Robert Walker, were crushed to death in a malfunctioning truck. And then they said they just had it because they had been struggling so much with not being protected and being invisible, and they took it upon themselves to strike. They even put on their suit to do it. And this was the night before Martin Luther King was assassinated, this strike. And he had been working with them and he helped them organize. And this was the night, the next night, he did this talk on the mountaintop speech. Everyone knows, I've been to the mountaintop. Did he go to the mountaintop? Yes and no. But he had seen something. He had seen something in working with the sanitation workers. He had seen, I think he had seen God more than he had ever seen God before. And that could be, we could be motivated to have an interior agency to do the work, not always political, just an interior agency to say what we need to say to be, you know, to have personhood. Today we have more. We have I Am Black Woman Next. This is from a gallery in Oakland by a dear friend, Shara Ekandao Gallery in Oakland, and she presents mostly art from black women, but mostly all people of color too. And this is, again, a statement for personhood, you know, that I thought is some of the things that are happening in today's world. And more identity. So when I wrote the Way of Tenderness, I had said in that book that identity is not the problem. And I thought for sure they would, you know, disown me at the Zen Center. Because identity is always talked about as the problem, you know, the thing that you will suffer with. And again, like I said, I'm my own explorer and I find my own meaning. And so I could understand what they were saying. I understood that because I felt it and experienced it. But as I sat with the question and the quest for serenity, I began to embody the silence that they were teaching, I started to hear that there was nothing wrong with identity. There was something wrong with the distortions we put on identity. Like there's nothing wrong with having identity. And that was in a relative place of being embodied. And that we needed a relative existence in order to meet the absolute truth of freedom, liberation, compassion, harmony, all of these things. You must come, it has to come through here. That's why I call it the gateway, that to explore our embodiment, race, sexuality, gender, anything that is embodied. It could be disability, class, anything that is embodied, that we can use, everything that we have is to be used. Otherwise, we wouldn't have gotten it, is to be used to meet compassion, used to meet, not to decide what compassion is from here. And then I'm going to give you some later, some compassion, and maybe I'll give you some love, and maybe I won't, and maybe, you know, all these kinds of things. That's in the mind. So in order to meet it, for me, I needed the silence that I was embodying within even this body, this relative body here. Even Buddha himself said it's time for the milk. Because if he died, how was he going to teach? How was he going to teach? And so this is what my quest was, and I began to see that there was a deep yearning for human beingness. And although being an activist was a path, and it addressed many of the things that were inside me and troubled inside me, the discovery for me took place in meditation and sitting still. The deeper discovery took place in those silent places by which I could then engage and act upon the world from that place. And it was different because I came into Zen as a nationalist, as a Pan-African nationalist. My nose is pierced. I have a lot of holes in my hair, bangles up to here. I was everything, and I still am. But I don't need that, but I still am. And I still can be that if that is the path by which I will come to engage the world with compassion. I can meet it. To go, and I was nervous, are they asking me to strip myself down? you know? And yes, they were, strip all that off. And I tried it. I stripped down my beliefs and my values. And then after 20 years before I wrote that book, The Way of Tenderness, I said, oh, this is another way to talk about it. And then what the Buddha talked about in terms of superiority and inferiority, that was the problem. And it could be race, sexuality, gender, disability, class, superiority. And I was just saying earlier to some of the staff that, you know, why doesn't a dozen of daisies cost $100? Why does it have to be roses? Because that's what they say. That's what they say. Who they are, I don't know. But that's what it's been said. And if somebody gave you a dozen daisies instead of the roses, I don't know how you might feel. Like, where did you get these? From the neighbors? You know. Thank you. Okay. Okay. That's learned. That's learned, and it permeates, and it's pervasive. And that's what I thought I had to talk about, because it couldn't be just race for me, it couldn't be just gender, it couldn't be just sexuality, it couldn't be just class, it was all of those things, because I'm all of those things. It couldn't be disability, just the one thing. So I honed in on superiority and inferiority, and that became the quest, you know, to develop and to create an interior agency. So I wanted to share something with you. So I already said, in essence, the spiritual quest is less about meditation or mindfulness and more about which path will lead to some sense of thriving through emotions rather, caused by prolonged mistreatment. We can talk about emptiness too if you want. Eruptions caused by prolonged mistreatment. So getting away from dehumanization or constant violence or poverty or scarcity. Now, I'm not going to go deeply into this, but how many did see a movie by Ava DuVernay on the Central Five Park people? Okay. One. There's one. Okay. Two. All righty. So we're not going to go deeply into that, but, you know, because we'd have a whole nother conference. But I just wanted to bring it forward. Because that, if you haven't seen it, is a movie that can tell you how perceptions are created around who's inferior and who's superior and what happens, you know, and how the story is gathered and constructed. So I definitely have to bring an old Zen master in, and this is one of my favorite ones. Rigen is an ancient Zen master, and I love this saying. He says, carving a cave of emptiness from a mountain of form leads to serenity from the ocean of misery. Carving a cave of emptiness from a mountain of form leads to serenity from the ocean of misery. If we carve a cave, a sanctuary, like we're having this week, within the mountain of misery, we are bringing our suffering. Will our essence freely abide? Is serenity available to all? And how is it expressed? So the first fear I get from most of my dear friends is, oh my God, I cannot be serene and go out and fight. And I understand it. I understand that. I understand it completely. And so we have to think about if one is embodying silence and serenity, how does one engage the world of all that's going on? And so that became further, going deeper with the quest. So not only looking at serenity, not only looking at it, but also looking at the depth of that question. You know, how do we engage that? So let me say, this is what I came up with my own definition for the Webster Merriam Dictionary. I called them up and let them know I've changed the definition for serenity to a consciousness beyond conflict with the expectations of the outer world. A consciousness beyond conflict with the expectations of the outer world. So this takes a twist and a turn on the mind, perceiving through one's senses, how one perceives it, which happened for me. I perceived serenity much more different than just being untroubled or peaceful or calm. I began to see that the conflicts in the world, within myself and in the world collectively, you know, were based on some expectations and from what I saw in the outer world. And so the quest for silence or serenity had to occur despite the chaos of the world. So many of us want to fix it and then we can sit. You know, I had one teacher tell me in the beginning, and she was a very wonderful teacher, and she said, "Oh yeah, one day racism will be over." Yeah. And I said, "What?" You know, and so she said, "Yeah, because what arises will cease." And I said, "Oh, that's so simplistic." It sounded so simplistic to me, you know. And of course, another teacher said, what we're doing now, this was in the Nietzschean world, said, what the work that we're doing now may not be for us right now, for us right now. We would like it to be. Maybe we're doing it for the year 3000. And that didn't feel good either. You know, it's like, well, wait a minute, I won't be here. I'm working too hard. I need to reap what I sow. And so it just became a more expansive quest and more expansive activism. And so personally, I did find that embodying blackness for me helped me write that book, The Way of Tenderness. And I claimed the embodiment, despite the teacher saying, let it loose, don't cling. I claimed it, I held on to it, and I wrote, only in deep silence of meditation did I begin to disbelieve that I was born only to suffer. Eventually, after many years of sitting meditation, I recognized the root of my self-hatred, both external and internal, as personal and collective denial on the denigration of the dark body I inhabited, as a personal and collective denial or denigration of the dark body I inhabited. I understood what ignorance meant. It means to ignore, to not meet anything that's living, not just us great superior human beings. Anything that is living, to ignore it, you know, and to disregard it. And so to me, I felt like my own practice was evidence that, yes, indeed, there's an embodied silence and serenity is available despite the oppression. I wanted to read from a book called The Radical Dharma. Lama Rod Owens is one of the authors, and he's an African-American Tibetan teacher, and he said, silence became the medium in which I was reborn into a sense of happiness and contentment. But overall, it ushered me into a period of thriving and flourishing in my life. So in essence, there can be a shift in the mind. Has it been measured? I don't know. I don't know who we're measuring. I haven't read enough studies. Has it been measured? You know, who's out of that? Who's missing in the study about wellness and mindfulness and meditation? So how do we go engage with life from an embodied serenity? And this is a really great question. So, and I've been studying Zen poetry, which is called Kado, K-A-D-O. And the old Zen masters, they didn't have books and, you know, you didn't go to their temple. You know, you just kind of drugged around with the teachers. And there were many women teachers and men teachers. You only hear about the men one. And one of my favorite teacher is Chioni. And there were just some very marvelous teachers who were also called Buddhas in their day. And so Kado is where Zen is taught through poetry so that one is awakened through the poem. So for example, there is a woman, I just learned of this woman through a teacher I'm working with called, the teacher is Ando McDonald, and she introduced me to Holly Wren Spalding, and one of the things she says is, become the field. So write it down, sit in silence, because we don't have a whole lot of time to do that, but become the field. And in that sense, it's to bring more silence and for you to awaken to yourself, not looking upon the field, being imposed upon the field, going into field, acting in the field, but being the field so that you can hear everything. You can hear a bird sing, you can hear a door slam, you can hear the water drop. You're listening to everything until you awaken to what life is. This is how they used to teach. This is it. And they would just keep giving you more, usually haiku, they used to call it hoku, and they would give you more of this teaching. You know, sometimes koans, I don't know, some people have heard of koans, that's also another way, which who am I, was who I asked earlier, who am I, who are we, is a koan. It's not to be answered, it's just to drop you deeper. If you answer it, that's okay. But tomorrow you'll have to ask it again. And again, and again, and again, and again. And this is the way the teachings went about. And so I felt for me that kind of teaching was a way of entering the silence without having a mind thing, all the things I had in my mind from what I read or what I was taught or all these things that I internalized. I love this book. If you know, might want to check this out. Let's see. Oh, that's my book. I love that book too. That's The Way of Tenderness. This book by Kevin Kwashi is a beautiful book. And he really, the quest in his book and the question was that African Americans are always seen as very dramatic and social action and going to take care of everything and going to do this and going to do that and going to march and going to protest. And he was saying, but there's also this sovereignty of quiet that exists. And he goes through the use of this novel that was written in 1953 called Maud Martha. And Maud Martha, if you read the novel, you will see she was an existentialist. And so in the times, in the early 50s, many of the black community were meditating and were existentialists. And then the movement, the civil rights movement, with James Baldwin and many of the other writers, started to write about the struggle, the black struggle, and the existentialist teachers through writing, through the novels, it dissipate. You know, because people weren't at that place at that time. So Kwashi brings back very beautifully this other essence, and so that we're all multidimensional. It's just basically what he's saying. And I love this book because he talks about that we can embody serenity. And I want to go back because I skipped over about the poetry. There's a term called shibui. Shibui, S-H-I-B-U-I, and it's a term they use. And shibui is to strip down, you know, your like your words and your poems in a sense, so that you can just, you know, feel the embodiment. So the form is essential as opposed to you making the form. So like a lot of times in our secular poetry, our praise poetry, we is I, me, you, and what I am doing. And that's good too, good poetry and good calling. But in a teaching way, in the Kado way, shibui is to drop that out for a moment so that the silence can come in. So I invite you, if you have any writings, to take a sentence or two and take out the I, my, and me and see what you got. Just to see, is it more open and accessible even to you? Or open and accessible to, you know, others? Does it create the silence and the serenity that you seek and that you already have inside of you? So watching the time. So I feel that you can engage the world. through this quest by fiercely sitting. Because once you get up, because once I got up, after being a Pan-Africanist and a nationalist, still in my, inside me, after I stood up over the years, took a long time, I began to talk about my experience and others' experience and even the oppression in a way I didn't know I could articulate, in a way I think that helped me understand it, so I shared it with others in that book, The Way of Tenderness. I shared a different view of how we might look at, actually used the Buddhist teachings of the ones that, I didn't say these are Buddhist teachings that help you, it's not that way. It doesn't come out that way. It's just how it was embodied in me to see appearance and to see a story and to see construction, you know, of self and construction of a life, you know, my own life. And so once I saw that, it didn't mean I had to work out, oh, I got to get rid of it. I used it. I took that package. I took that book. I call it, you know, my workbook, my spiritual workbook. And I used it to walk and understand those teachings, absolute teachings, because that's the only way. Otherwise, you're doing something conjured. Aren't I loving and kind? Somebody says, no, I don't think that wasn't loving. And you're like, well, wait a minute. What shall I do? What shall I do? And it's to just hold it, inherently hold the quest and the question and the inquiry, because this is all about inquiry. As researchers, if you decided before you say, here's the question, and I already know the answer, so I'll just write it up, it wouldn't be a great research study, right? So you walk it, you walk that quest, and you talk to people, you walk, it may take years. You may want to finish it very fast, but it doesn't happen that way. And you may discover, hopefully, you discover something incredibly different and incredibly new. That always just makes me so joyful. That's joy, to find something different about our human beingness. That just lights me up. Sometimes even when I'm suffering, you know, people say, one of my students said, you're suffering so much, and I have been through a lot of transitions, and she said, how are you doing it? I said, I'm actually interested in it. You know, actually fascinated by how much I am suffering and looking at it. And not to say I don't get depressed or cry or whatever, because I'm a human being. But there's something exciting in it if I stay with it. And it's very hard to stay with it. Very difficult. But that's the practice. Because what have you been doing other than meet the crucial moment? You know, take out your bag and pull up all your tools you've gathered. That's the time to work. You got a lot of tools, take it out the bag and work. When everything, bam, there you are, flat on your back. That's how you're going to meet serenity. Oh, on the ground. Oh, that's that thing. What's that? Or you might have another word for it. And you could teach others about that. You teach your friends, your community, your students, your children, you know. We're not here to take on what has been taken on already. We're here to take off from what has already happened, you know, to take off from there. And we can do that from being aware of our experiences. So I wanted to read this. More seconds. Oof, sorry to get a bunch of stuff in a short time. So this is something, I do have a breakout group coming, and I will read another poem that I wanted to read today. I'll read that, and I think it'd be great because it's about competition, you know, and how we compete. But this one I thought is good for now. It's called The Deep. Silence guides us to the interior, where the moss has grown in layers and bamboo sinks itself into you. the innermost earth has no words, but the deep does not think. It calls. It calls. Go unafraid into the dark, into your life, without doubt that the heart is open. Without doubt, your heart is open. Makes us very vulnerable to know that. So I wrote that many years ago, sitting in a monastery. So I think I will end there so that we can have a dialogue, which is my favorite part. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Sensei, for your humility and wisdom and sharing from your friendship with silence. So we have about 20 minutes for questions, and there's roving mics, and I'll call on you. And I just want to remind us about our earlier discussion about agreements. So during the question and answer period, maybe one of our agreements, moving up, moving back, can be in our minds. So we want to encourage full participation, and if you tend to speak often, maybe you can move back and vice versa. And as my friend Roshi Joan Halifax used to say, see if we can go to essence in our question. Keep it short, since our time is precious. So who would like to begin?
I'm open to any questions. It doesn't have to be about just the talk.
Thank you so much. On the road here, I was reading from the piece that was provided to us from your book, Body as Nature, I believe was the title. So there was a notion of things being perfect, or the process being perfect there. And I feel like it made me think. And I promise I'll read the rest of the book too. So this was like a piece taken from the book. But I just wanted to hear more about that. What does it mean to you? Not just accepting things as they are, but also seeing them as perfect. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for that question. No, never perfect. No, very difficult. We have two black Dharma transmitted teachers in the Soto Zen and the Suzuki Roshi lineage. One is Afro-Cuban and the other one is me. And we were the only two in the 70-year history of that institution. 70 years. There are about five, unless somebody came up, and I don't know, five black Dharma transmitted teachers, and I'm one of those five. So it's very few of us, and I think the struggle is for me, I can say, was being considered someone who really was seeking the Dharma. And a lot of times I felt that I was viewed as coming to do something else other than that. And quickly, a lot of us, people of color, are put on diversity committees or inclusivity committees. And, you know, I joined it in the beginning, and I think I was off in a month or so. Because it wasn't where I wanted to be. And so, like I said, it took me all those years to write about it, because I wanted to write about it not from my Pan-Africanist and socialist and nationalist point of view, but to write about it from the aspect of Dharma, from the perspective, because the Dharma had to address it. If the Dharma didn't address this embodiment, then there was no need for me to be there. And so that was the quest. So yes, I ran into incredible, racism, homophobia, all of it. Everything that's in the world was in that community, spiritual community. And I've been in other communities with people of color where there's still lack of understanding of black people. So it just was continuous. There was no considered, utopia, place of utopia. And so that meant that this quest for serenity would have to, go deeper for me in order for me to live a full life. I have some friends who may not take their students to Zen Center, and they're waiting for the racism to end. And I, when is it going to end? Why can't they go and enjoy the hot springs? I go with them so that, I can navigate. They get a navigator, and it's a lot of navigation because of the things people ask them, ridiculous questions when they come. You would think they dropped off the moon or something. We're on the same planet, And so I think that it was okay for me. You have to choose it. I chose that pit. I chose to just get down in the belly of the beast. I chose it because something was changing in me. I could feel it. I could feel myself being less and less and less concerned about, even though I still had woundedness, but I was less concerned. It was no longer center stage. My suffering was in center stage. It was just there. And I could use it. I could engage it. And because of that, I'm sitting in this chair right now. And I wrote the book. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here because I'm very shy. It really talks really just like, oh no. And I do a lot. And after here, I'm going someplace else and I got 4 more talks. So don't write unless, don't write a book if you're never interested in talking. So it was hard. It was not perfect. And the imperfection, and then there was the perfections, the rituals, the ceremonies. Sometimes I would just be, and still, I'll go to teach, and there's just this, the tears just roll when I see the students do some of the ceremonies. I go, that's my yes. That's why I came. That's my yes. And I'm not going to let anybody take it away. I don't recommend it for everyone. This one right here.
Thank you. Down right front, here, yeah.
Hi, thank you so much for your talk. My name is Grant Jones. I'm wondering if you could unpack more about what some of you just brought up just now about this kind of tension where our places of practice are kind of riddled with homophobia, racism. I know, speaking from my personal experience, I know that I was surprised, not surprised, but dismayed, I think, when I sought or wanted to seek refuge in spiritual community and was met with the same forces that, operate in the external world. Mm-hmm. But also, I think what was saddening about that to me is, there was no active investigation into those forces. Mm-hmm. And I also noticed that oftentimes the internal practice was actually used to mask over this letting go of identities was then used to suppress the very real forces that were operating, in our spiritual spaces. And and so I was wondering kind of how you've navigated that tension and what you think the role of spiritual communities are. And you could speak, from your particular lineage as well, of doing that unpacking actively, because that's something that I feel like has been missing.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. Yes. Let's see. When I went in, I wanted them to do their work. And then I decided I'm going to do my work. And then when I did my work, I came back with that book. They were surprised. They were like, oh, you experienced racism? Because I never talked about it. And I was like, whoa, that's why I wrote the book. And so they were very shocked. And blind and had intentions not to be and all that. And the whole no self, and you know, we're not going to hold on to, we're not going to do identity, we're not going to be doing race, is why I wrote the book, and that's why I insist it is the gateway. Because why else do we got this? It is the gateway for you. First, you take the gateway. I tell my students, don't go there trying to change the 70-year institution. I say, sit, eat their food, rest, and write poetry, and when you come out, do that thing. Do it. Do what it is you to do. Engage in the world from that place of what came up for you. Use it as a lab. To use it. Everything that's in the world is for us to use. The worst of the horrors. There's a lot of horror, isn't there? A lot of horror. We can't turn away from it. We have to engage it. And so, because one day we're going to turn away anyway, right? One day it's going to be over, so why turn away early? Why die young? Engage it for yourself. Make it active. I made my practice active. And everything that was said and done, that little pen, you know, those essays have been writing in themselves all along. Or the work I do, or how I teach my primarily African-American Sangha. You know, I wouldn't be able to teach them in that way, or they wouldn't be able to even consider Zen. You know, fortunately, I had to shut my gateway down because there was people all over the country and out of the country trying to reach me, and there's just me unless I can't clone it. And so I think that my advice is this is what I did. It might not be what you can do. It might be too much what they call dukkha, suffering in there, and you don't have to do it. You don't have to do it this way. There are other ways of practicing Zen. Like I said, I'm practicing Zen now through Kado, through poetry, but the teacher that's doing the way of poetry. There's many different ways, you know, to enter, many gateways. So don't suffer more. I was suffering until my mindset changed to say, oh, this is really knocking you out here. Maybe you should stay. And I was like, oh, maybe not. This is crazy. My friends were like, what are you doing over there? You know, why are you doing this? And now, you know, they can see. And now they come to me and sit with me to hear what I had to learn. Like I said, I don't recommend it for everybody. I even think for me it was very difficult because I have a very weak spine. Sometimes you just say one little thing and I'm like, you know, but it's okay. I just go on and cry and do my little thing and then I'm okay. You know, I just keep, and I begin to see, I can't live there. You can't live there crying like you did when you were 8 years old at that white school I went to. With my pigtails, you can't do that. All your life, you're going to die early, and I don't want to die early. I want to live fully. And so, when it happens daily. You know, I experience unconscious movement around me, even here. And how do you deal with that? Don't worry about it, everybody. You know, just notice. And then I used to like that would throw me and lock me in my room. Now I just let it, because I'm not there. I don't join that. And I do speak that. I think it has to be spoken. But if you go in with that's your only intention, you're going to miss out on the retreat. I mean, I was in a people of color group, and that's how I entered Zen, in a people of color group. It was all happy, yay. And in the end, we were getting ready to go somewhere, and everybody had a ride but the black people to the retreat. And I remember that night. I was like, wow. So it's the superiority, inferiority. It can happen anywhere. What is it, and how do you navigate it? How do you live with it? How do you use it? How do you bring it into your art of life? There's always art with the Japanese traditions, there's always art, poetry, calligraphy, everything to show you where you're at. So put it there until you're ready to speak from that silence, not from the mind or what you know or the pain, but from that silence that speaks. And I mean not quiet and not sensory only either, not just how you feel, not all the senses, how I feel. But there's another quiet that doesn't have, Rumi speaks of it, that doesn't have any, you know, all of that, it's just there. So I call it the silence of the silence. You know, Shibui is that, you know, kind of stripped down just so you could hear. The form is let go of just to hear, and it's also held. So you've seen the Enzo all the time, the Japanese Enzo for Zen, that's what it means. It means it's full and it's empty. It's the form of emptiness. So emptiness has form, and form has emptiness. That is the universal way of life. And so you're going to understand it by tugging with the people. Oh, what did he say? What did she say? Oh, my God, no. And you tug and you tug as long as you can. And then you go somewhere else and you tug some more. Right? You tug at school or whatever, you know, because it's at school too. You know, people go right to the universities. They don't try to tear down a 100-year-old institution. They just get the degree and go home. So why go to the student center and tear it down? You're not going to do it. Don't knock yourself up against the wall. But I don't think you can speak to it. You must speak to it. It's not a silence that doesn't speak. It's a silence that speaks from the silence. That's very profound. And teaching. Be a teacher. Be the teacher you are. You're a teacher. If you can see, you can teach. Mm-hmm. Thank you. One more, I guess.
Yes, we have time for one more question. Someone here at the end, yes.
Hi. My name is Nilesh, and I want to ask you, how were you introduced to Buddhism? And I mean, what is it that fascinated you? Because you said you used to go to church and ask a lot of questions.
Yes.
And you have touched upon, but still I am asking that, what was the reaction of, you know, your parents or community when you decided to move on to Buddhism? Right. Because you said you are the first person in 70-year tradition.
Yeah, they were pretty shocked. They still are. You know, when I show up at the, I'm gonna stand up for a minute, when I show up at the Zen Center, this brown is a color, it means I can ordain, and it's Dharma transmission, it's the last training, and there's three colors, and so they still think I'm the student, even with the brown on. So I just, when it happens, the ignorance shows up, because someone asks me, are you another teacher, so-and-so's Jisha, which means that's the person that helps the teacher. And I was a teacher, so you don't help the teacher. So I have this brown robe, and I'm standing there, and I'm going, I said, no, I'm not so-and-so's Jisha. And then she kept asking, aren't you so-and-so's Jisha? And I finally said, no, I'm not. But I could feel inside this violence, you know, rage and like, hoodoo, baby. I really could feel it. And I was like, And I walked away, and it said something to me. First of all, who do I think I am? First of all, that was huge. It was like, whew. Blap, 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 blap. Wake up. And so I could use it. That's how I used it. But then at the same time, I used it to teach my students who were with me about it. Now, I could decide to engage that person, but I didn't. In the end, later, like maybe a couple of days later, the person came back to me. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm you know, so I didn't have to do anything. She came to her own awakening somehow, somewhere down the way. I didn't do that work. I came to Buddhism. It came to me. I didn't know anything about Buddhism. Some friends were into it, and I came. I started reading, and I said, That's exactly what God was saying. You know? And I was like, except the way they're saying it, I think it could happen, because the church I went to, it didn't seem like that was happening. And I went to church all the way up to my 30s, and I was very active. They were very shocked. I was a teacher there too when I left. And I still hold Jesus Christ as somebody who probably had some, you know, they distorted his teachings. I still hold them. And the way they talk about him today, it's like, where did you get that? You know, he loved everyone. He was with everyone. He would love anyone, anyone. That's why I loved that. And when I saw that love in Buddhism as well. There's no God in Buddhism, but there's love in Buddhist teachings, because God is love, right? So I could see that. It was no division for me. I also practice African religion as well. But it was hard to do on an everyday basis, the number of sacrifices and things. And I still do have connections to many, many African teachers. And they actually contact me. I have two Mambo priests in Haiti waiting for me to come. They want to learn Zen. You know, so it's just, there's, you know, we make that division, you know. And it's difficult, you know, not easy. I tell people I'm just weird. I accept it. And I tell my students, it's got a weird teacher, so it's okay. It wasn't okay all the time. I was very sad about being set aside, but now I get it. And there is another thing called sabishi. So we did shibui, but there's sabishi. Sabishi is being alone, but it's a spiritual aloneness. It's not an aloneness like, I'm so alone. It's a spiritual aloneness where you're such a pilgrim in on the path. You can feel that. It's sabishi. S-A-B-I-S-H-I-I. Sabishi. And so I feel that a lot. But I accept it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sensei.